Oxish number 10602, reel 31.
Mr. Elliot, reel 31. Could you continue telling me about the leave that you got prior to D-Day, your compassionate leave?
I got a 48-hour pass and was taken from the unit by the one vehicle which was left there. It was, I forget the name of the transport. They had a special name for this one vehicle. It used to go into Thetford, either to the railway to pick up reinforcements or post. It was like a messenger, you know, a detailed driver daily, and he would go into Thetford or anywhere where it was required for that. And he had to go into Thetford, and he took me to Thetford. But I was rather surprised when I got to Thetford and got my ticket. Instead of going, which was, I think, the normal route to Norwich, and then onto the main line, I had to go to March, a railway station called March, for to transfer from there to onto the main line, because they were taking trains off and what have you. And each time I went to a station, I made inquiries for the time of the train leaving and what time I would get a train back. I forget which mainline station I got to, but anyhow, I managed to get to Durham, and I asked the railway staff there what time I would get a train back, and they gave me times. I went home and found when I got home I only had about an hour at home to return to catch these trains.
How long had the journey taken you to get up there?
Oh, it took about 24 hours. And
you had what, 2 days leave?
I had 48 hours passed. But there were so many trains not running or taking off that I came to the conclusion while I was waiting in maybe one of the station waiting rooms that D-Day couldn't be so far away when this was happening. And I got home, I saw the baby. I was my sister-in-law, my younger sister-in-law, had gone to my home to look after the wife while she was having the baby, and it wasn't necessary really for me to be there at the time, although at the time I didn't know my sister-in-law would be available. Anyhow, I saw the baby, saw the wife, and I saw they were comfortable, and I was in the house I think 2 hours when I had to return.
What did you feel about having to go back?
Well, I knew I had to go back, and I knew it had been a privilege to get that 48 hours because very few people would have got it. I think only deaths would have got it. And
do you remember what month this was that you'd actually got
the... Oh, yes, May. The daughter was born on the 25th of May, and I got home a couple of days after that. And as you realise, D-Day was the 6th of June, but I think it should have been the 5th. So you'll understand from my reckoning and what I was beginning to think. Well, anyhow, I returned to Durham Railway Station for the train which I'd been told just a few hours before would be on, wasn't on. So I had to go to the RTO and ask him to sign my pass to say I had tried to get back on time. Well, he said, the next train you might get to York and you'll have to change at York. So I got to York and I asked the railway staff there if there was a train going to East Anglia. They said, "Not no more tonight." But I said, there was supposed to be one going at such and such a time. Oh, that's been taken off. So I said to the ticket, the man at the barrier, if I could leave the station without handing me ticket in and to come back when the next train. He said, "Oh, yes." He said, "There's the restaurant up there. You can go and have a cup of tea or whatever you like." Anyhow, I left the station, and I heard there was a large military convoy passing quite close to the station. So I went down to the military policeman who was directing traffic, and I asked him if the traffic was going to East Anglia, and he asked why. And I said, well, there was no more trains to East Anglia, I was due back at Rivalli the next morning. And if the transport was going to East Anglia, could he get me a lift on one of the vehicles? He says, lad, get yourself back to the railway station, go to the Salvation Army, ask them to give you a bed. He says, and forget about it, because you will not get a lift on military transport passing through York. So I said, well, this is funny, railways is, and the military policemen are not assist this way, but tell me to go back. So I went back and asked the Salvation Army if they could give me a bed for the night. And they said, the person of the Salvation Army asked me what time the train was. I said, well, I didn't know, but I would find out. If I was a bed, then I would find out the time for to be called up. And I spoke to the railway staff again, and they said they expected a train to go in the early hours of the morning. So I bedded down and asked the Salvation Army, called me up about half an hour before the train was due to go. I had a cup of tea, got on the train, but the train was stopped at various places. By the time I got back to Riddlesworth Park Camp,
this is the camp in East Anglia.
In East Anglia, I was given a lift by an American transport. One of their transports was at the station, and as was usual in those days, if the Americans was going into Thetford, you asked for a lift, they would give you one, providing, you know, it was suitable.
Did you manage to get back to the camp in time?
No, I was absent. I think the back of my pass had more RTO signatures on it, stating the times and whatever I'd been there. I knew my company commander would accept that I'd try to get back. And the battalion was out on a parade when I got back. And I was absent off that parade. It was an inspection by General Montgomery. He was inspecting and telling the men what was to happen. Well, I got this from the members of the company and the sergeant's mess afterwards. But I wasn't on that parade. I should have been on, but I was missing.
Can we move on now to looking at preparations of the battalion and yourself for moving from Thetford?
Well, we had already had instructions, because the camp was more or less sealed. You know, we weren't allowed to go out, we weren't allowed to come in. But what I was going to say was that when I returned and I had my interview with the company commander for being late, he said, well, what do you think was happening? I said, well, I think D-Day will not be very far away. And I explained the situation to him, and he was rather surprised at hearing the information from me, what I knew, and he came to a very similar conclusion. Now then, we knew what was to happen. And on D-Day, there was, through the night, coming up to D-Day, there was heavy aircraft all over the air for hour upon hour upon hour. And we got up, we had our breakfasts, and we just packed our gear. The American transport came to the camp, took us to Thetford.
What day was this, can you remember?
D-Day, the morning of D-Day, about 8, when I say morning, it was, I think we left camp before 9 o'clock, but I could be wrong there for a matter of minutes or either way. But we already knew what we had to do, and as soon as we knew these aircraft, and then when the radio was on, it was said it was D-Day, we packed all our gear and we were ready for moving out within very short time. And as I say, all this was known. The Americans came with their transport, took us to Thetford Station, we embarked and trained, and we were on our way. Now, we were passing through North London before midday, and we arrived at New Haven in the early afternoon, and we were briefed that we would be sailing that night, weather permitting.
So when you arrived at New Haven, what did the battalion do there?
Well, we marched into another seal camp, and we were told we couldn't leave, couldn't write letters. We could write letters and post them, but they wouldn't be posted until later. We were then made up to field certain equipment we hadn't got was issued, such as certain NCOs were given watches, binoculars, map cases for the area where we were going. But we weren't given the maps. We didn't get the maps until we were leaving.
Did you at that time know where you were going?
No, we just knew we were going across the channel to join the beachhead, as we had trained, as I'd explained earlier, we had trained as a assault division. So we were fully trained to take on the job if the assault divisions had failed. We were ready to go in. We were trained to go in.
What were your emotions at this point when you knew that you were about to land in France?
I think I would be lying if I didn't say I was a bit nervous. Having experienced Dunkirk, I had never experienced our side being in the superiority in aircraft. But I knew if we had the aircraft, I knew we would be better off. There was no doubt about the Army or the Navy, but if there was that doubt about the aircraft, and as we'd been reading, the 1,000 bomber raids and that leading up, it seemed obvious that we must have superior air strength than the Germans at that time, otherwise I don't think they would have done it. That was my feelings then. But most of the lads were quite happy. They weren't shouting for joy, but they knew the time had come. They'd been training for it. They were really worked up and took the point. And then when we were kept in New Haven camp for about 4 days, the elation began to wane. They were getting tired of being in a sealed camp, couldn't go out, although the camp authorities did their utmost in every way to try and alleviate the boredom. But the boredom was there, because you see, we couldn't go out.
What did they do to try and alleviate the boredom?
There were cinemas. The meals were fairly regular and pretty canny.
Was it better food than you'd been used to?
No, I wouldn't say it was better, but I wouldn't say it was any worse. Because, you see, they were only expecting troops to be there for a very short while. In one morning and out at night.
Did you yourself do anything to try and keep the men in your section's morale high?
Oh, I used to go and see to them and have a bit talk with them. I remember one incident. It didn't affect the men of my regiment, but it was two Scots lads. They were standing outside the Catholic padre's tent. Now, the padre would take confessions or speak to the lads if they wanted to go in and see him. He was a good padre. And these two lads, they said, "Oh, shouldn't have gone in battle and gone in there and see him, man." They were going on in the way. So I walked up to them. I said, "Look, lads," I said, "you go in there and speak to Father Good," I think that was his name, and I said, "you'll be surprised what a kind of man he is." And they looked at me. He says, "do you think so?" I said, "I'm certain." I said, "just pop in and have a word with him." And those two lads went into the tent and they saw the padre, where they were very apprehensive before they'd seen me. But he was a padre I knew, and he was a very good padre.
Was he from the DLI?
No, he was from the Corps of Chaplains. But he was, I think, the padre for our battalion. You see, each battalion had a padre. They needn't necessarily be Church of England or whatever, but they had a padre, and we had this padre. Now, what I can say about this padre was that whenever we were on exercises, anywhere, if there was tea made, the lads would say to the padre, if he came during that period of time, "what about a pot of tea?" Now, the lads wouldn't have done that if they didn't like him. That is the an honour for anybody to get a cup of tea when they're, in the training, because the lads would usually want to drink it themselves. But whenever he appeared, and I mean this, that from the time I was with the 10th Battalion, on schemes, training, whatever it was, and there was any tea up, and that padre came, they would offer him a pot of tea.
Can you tell me about your movement from this camp at New Haven then?
Well, we moved at night. We moved at night onto the London Ships Infantry. We got on and we left. I think it would be the night of the 10th. I'm not certain of the date, but I think it would be about the 10th when we left on the night, and we travelled over the Channel in the dark.
What sort of ship were you on? Was it a large ship?
London Ship Infantry. It would take about a company of men. It wasn't a huge ship, but it was... when we got to Normandy, to where we had to change over from the London Ship Infantry to the assault craft, there were so many men got into each of the assault craft.
How was that organised, getting into the assault craft?
Oh, just over the side, down netting or ladders, rope ladders. I think it was mostly netting though, but the practice is.
Was it easy to get into the assault craft from the...
Oh aye, from the London Ship's Infantry. And then, well, there was London Ship's tanks, you know, they just carried the tanks and the tank crews. They were long things, you had the bond. But we landed in an infantry ship, and then we transferred to an assault craft. The funny thing about the one we got in, the one I was in, we were quite a distance between the ship and the shore when our landing craft began to sink. So the lad who was driving the landing craft, he shouted to another one, because there was quite a number, they were running around like taxis. And he shouted for another one, and he came alongside, and we just transferred from that one to the other. And then the lad just drove the ship he had, straight the landing craft, straight to the beach. Otherwise he would have sunk. Well, I don't know why.
Hadn't been hit by anything.
Not while we were there. There was nothing... I think at the time the Royal Navy was firing from their warships.
What time did you actually transfer from the into the assault craft?
Not sure of the time, but it was day. It was light.
It was morning.
Morning. It was just after dawn, I think.
From the actual assault ships, what could you see of the beach? What did it look like from there?
Just like any beach from a distance. You see, the assault divisions had gone in. There was marked out areas with white tape, but you couldn't see that from the ship because you were too far away. Maybe a mile, half a mile away, you know, you couldn't see it very clearly. You could see buildings, and you could obviously see that there were gun emplacements or, you know, defensive points. You could see the concrete, you know, the shape of the buildings.
Was there any firing and activity going on at that time? Any fighting?
There was on land, but not from us. You know, we landed quite quietly. We had no bother landing, you know, the odd ship, maybe it's land craft.
Had you received your orders by now and knew exactly where you were going and what you should be doing?
Well, we hadn't been told where we were going because I don't think they knew where the front was. But we moved from the beach through Bayeux, and we went into the country, and just outside of Bayeux, I think it was, we... saw the notices of the 51st and the 50th Divisions, and we passed through them, and as I explained before, I think, when we went through these lads, they looked very tired. There was the usual chit-chat between the lads in the weapon slits and us passing them, you know. I think they were relieved to find that there was some more infantry coming to give them a break. I think that was the, you know, the wariness of them.
Could you describe the terrain that you passed through from the beach to Bayeux?
The way it was a slight slope from the beach. There was you see, they hadn't completely cleared the beaches of the mine, so you just couldn't go. You had to follow a track, a white tape track, and we got onto the road. The roads had been cleared, otherwise the transport couldn't have gone through. And we just passed through.
Was it still fairly flat country?
No, it was a little bit up and downy, but it wasn't steep. You know, there would be little inclines, and then you would move on. Now we moved through, and I'm not sure where, but we moved into a field waiting for our transport, for the battalion transport and everything else to come. And we were there a day in a field. There was a stream running through about the middle of the field, but when we looked around, we could see on the higher ground where tanks had been knocked out, where they'd brewed up. The odd one here, the odd one there. You know, we could see there'd been, we knew there'd been action in that area.
Was that the only sign of fighting you could see? These?
That was up till then. That was the only fighting where we'd seen. There was nothing taking place, but we knew it had taken place within a short while.
Were there any bodies lying around or that?
Not there. They were distant away. We were away from them. We couldn't see. Now, when the battalion was on land and the transport was on land, we moved from that area to another area, into a farming area, and it was like a little valley we went into. There weren't steep sides, you know, but it was low. We went through low ground, so if there was any enemy in the offing, we would be what can you say, they couldn't observe us, let's put it that way. And we moved to an area where we were told we would remain there on the night. Now, that was a Friday. I know it was a Friday, but the date I couldn't tell you. It was near a Friday near to the 11th of... after the 11th of June. And we were told we would be there just for the night, and tomorrow we could expect to go into action. Now, we dug in, and I got the lads the meal. We had 24-hour packs or various things, 48-hour packs of food. And I got the lads a meal straight away. But before I was able to make tea, I saw a farmhouse, and I went up to the farm and asked if I could have some water from his well, and he refused point blank. And I was offering to pay him in French, in the occupation money, and I offered to pay him the money for the water, and he refused point blank. He wouldn't let me have water for to make the troops, the lads under me, a meal. So I took a couple of 36 grenades out of me pouches, and I said if I couldn't have water, he wouldn't have water. And when he saw the grenades, he let me have the water. I paid him for it, but he let me have the water. But I had to threaten him with grenades in his well, otherwise I wouldn't have got the water. And I felt that was, I said, back to France again. Typical. Anyhow, when we got back down the field, we saw there was a farm cart, a four-wheel farm cart, like an ear wagon of sort. And when I looked at it, I saw there was a wire. Now, I knew if our lads had gone anywhere near it, it would have been a disaster. So I informed our lads, then I went to the company sergeant major, and I informed the company sergeant major. I thought there was booby traps on the on this wagon, and could he get the engineers to come and sort it out? And he said yes, but he said I don't know when it'll be done, but he says we'll put something, notices up to keep the troops away. So they put notices around it, keep off. And then the next morning we had an O group, and we were told we would move a little bit further up into a little copse, and then in the afternoon we'd go into action, and we were given specific details of what ground we were expected to take, and the what is it now?
The objective.
Well, with the objective, but as beyond the objective, what is the word? The distance. Anyhow, we were told how far we should go and then stop. And when we stopped, if we'd taken the ground, to dig straight in and await the counterattack.
How did you get the orders to follow? Where did they come from?
Well, there was an O group called by the company commander for officers, platoon commanders. And then the platoon commander came back, and we had a O group of the platoon of all section leaders. That was myself, the Lance Sergeant, who was a section leader, the two corporals, the 2-inch mortar, lance corporal, and the Piat, the lance corporal IC Piat. And they were all given their instructions, what they should do and how they should do it, if it was possible, you know, according to the exigencies of the area. So the opening up was, there was an artillery barrage, and we were told that if there was any difficulties with the enemy, we only had to ring up for the Air Force, and the Air Force would come in. And this was joy to me after being at Dunkirk, you know, just to ring up and say we want an aeroplane.
So there were field telephones already laid down?
There was observation officers there. We only had to give the word to the forward observation officers, maybe it's from the Royal Artillery or somewhere, and they just had to have the word, and they were there within minutes.
How did they pass the message back, these forward observation officers?
What, maybe by radio, I wouldn't know, but on top of that, at various times, there was aircraft just circling, waiting, typhoons, were just waiting, rocket firing typhoons, they were just waiting for an instruction. And when we went in, we were supported by warships, gunnery, from field regiments of artillery. And then there was the heavy support battalion with their 4.2 mortars, I think, or 3-inch mortars, something. We only carried 2-inch mortars. Our carrier platoon might have had 3. I just forget that. But there was the heavy support unit behind us. And when we went in, we were the left flank but company, and my platoon was the reserve platoon for the company. That's when we went into action.
Right, can you describe your what actually happened in the action?
Well, we were told the time to start, when we would start, and we started.
What time did you start?
Oh, I couldn't tell you the time. It was around about midday. It was just about midday. We went in. And the two platoons went in with two sections up and a section behind, a reserve, the platoon HQ in the middle. And we were the reserve, which went in behind the two platoons. And I was with platoon, with the rear section, with platoon HQ in the rear section. And the platoon commander, Mr. Mackey, went forward. We'd taken what I thought was a fair amount of ground, but I could see the company, or the companies on our left, receiving a bit of a bashing. We didn't get it as much. We were being fired on, but not as severe as the right-hand companies. We were the left-hand company. The other two companies on the right, they were receiving a bit of a hammer, and I saw quite a number of people fall. I didn't know who they were, but I saw them fall, and they didn't move. And just before we got to the edge of the village of Saint-Pierre, which was the place we were taken, some part of the battalion was to take Tilly-sur-Sales, and we were taking Saint-Pierre, the next village up, not very far from it, on the left of Tilly. And we took the village. When we got into the village, there was a little crossroads junction, and there was a tank which had been hit. I don't know if it was one of ours or one of the Germans, but there was, the turret was on the ground with half the body of a crew, member of the crew in, and the other half the body was still on the tank when we went in. But we passed through the village, we went through the orchard.